I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for June 4th, 2009. As the people in the audience can see, we have a long agenda. We're going to be jumping back and forth all during the meeting. So I'm going to first go to House Bill 2370, and can the committee administrator give a brief overview while Senator Walker comes forward to testify on the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2370A requires insurers offering liability, personal injury protection, or collision coverage to offer discount to motorcycle operators who've completed the motorcycle rider education course established under ORS 802.320. It specifies only one motorcycle per operator is eligible for the discount, and the motorcycle must not be used for business. We have the Dash A2 amendment for policies. Clarifies that for policies that cover motorcycles and other vehicles, limits premium reduction to motorcycle portions only. We do have the fiscal and revenue on the Dash A2 amendment. And
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and it's really hot in here.
It is.
So maybe it will encourage people to get done quicker with their testimony.
Did you see
today
our agenda, Senator Walker?
Yes, I did. I'm needed down in public safety sub for work sessions, so I'll be quick. This bill is a very simple little bill. Unfortunately, it got it caught up in some politics. I'm not quite sure why, but I got and stuffed a House bill so that I could have this bill before you today, and it simply allows motor vehicle insurance companies, or actually doesn't allow, it requires them, thank you, Sarah, to provide a discount to on your motor vehicle insurance policy for your motorcycle only. And that's what the Dash 2 Amendment does, Mr. Chair. It clarifies it is limited only to motor vehicles. So if you have received a rider training course and you ask for a discount on your motorcycle insurance, that discount will be applied to your motorcycle, not to all your other vehicles. That's up to the insurance company. This request came at the request of Dave Barrows, who is the lobbyist for Progressive Insurance, and it was quite funny because when he mentioned it, I'm watching television that night, and lo and behold, a TV commercial for Progressive appears on the screen, and they say they are the largest insurer of motorcycles in the country. So I thought that was sort of kismet. But the reason, this is a companion bill to another bill that is down in Ways and Means that will phase in motorcycle rider training over a five-year period, because statistics have shown over and over again that riders who receive the training have less chance of dying on the roadway because they become very excellent riders in anticipation of the drivers out there on with regular motor vehicles who tend to not see us and run over us and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. So the as a motorcycle rider myself, Mr. Chair, I find that the training is important and the discount should be offered because it makes us a better rider. So that's what this bill is about, and I hope you are inclined to pass it today because it had a rough road getting here.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Any questions for Senator Walker? Yes, Senator Atkinson.
If it's American-made Harley-Davidson, is it a lower rate than if it's Japanese-made Honda?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, I don't really make that distinction here, and I have to admit that I ride a 250 Kawasaki as my training bike, but I'm going to upgrade this summer, and it might include an upgrade to a Harley-Davidson.
Other question?
Yes. I think it's on the subject, Senator.
It actually is on the subject. Is there a CC, the serious question, is there a CC legal definition of what is a motorcycle?
We choose.
Yes, there is.
Mr. Chair.
It's over 50, is that right?
Senator Atkinson, I can't answer that, but I know there is one in the statute, and someone else could answer that who's smarter than I about that statute, but yes, it is.
Huh.
It is defined in the statute.
Thank you.
Okay, any additional questions for Senator Walker? Seeing none, did you want to make a final statement?
Only that Bike Pack is neutral on the bill. I love that. They're neutral on my other bill. They're all about safety and insurance and good things happening on motorcycles. So,
thank you very much, Senator
thank
Walker.
Thank you.
Might have a friendly Eagle Knievel.
Mr. Barrows, will you please come forward, or do you wish to say anything?
She said it all for me. Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
The time.
Ms. Barrows, could you come forward anyway just for a moment?
I hate that.
So,
As long as Senator Atkinson doesn't ask me any technical questions, sir.
Okay. Mr. Barrows, could you state your name for the record and just say what the position of your the clients you are representing is on the legislation?
Sir, I'm happy to. Mr. Chairman, Dave Barrows, representing Progressive Auto Insurance. We are in support of this bill with the Dash 2 amendments, which clarify the senator's intent. She's the one who gave us a note. She's fine. The rest of the insurance lobby is fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Barrows? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
I did that because there's been a note in another committee that nods from the audience are not really recorded. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2370, and I'm going to open a work session on 2370. Could the committee administrator please briefly explain the Dash 2 amendments?
The Dash A2 amendment, members, is it replies to policies that cover motorcycles and other vehicles and limits premium reduction to motorcycle portions only. We do have a no revenue impact on the Dash A2 and a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash A2 amendment.
Okay. Is there a motion on the Dash A2 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2370.
Okay. The Dash 2 amendments to HB 2370 have been moved. Is there any additional discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Is there a motion on the main bill now as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I move that 2370 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved. House Bill 2370 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Senator Walker will carry. I am going to open a public hearing on 2895. Senator Harker, or Representative Harker, would you please come forward and the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2895A directs Secretary of State to designate organizations to establish citizen panels to review and create statements on specified number of initiated state measures. Specifies process for reviewing statements, directs Secretary of State to print statements in voters' pamphlets, send such January 2nd, 2011, declares an emergency, is effective upon passage, comes to you from the House floor on a 47-12 excused vote. We have no amendments currently.
Okay, Representative Harker, would you please begin?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senate Rules Committee. Thanks for allowing me to be here today. For the record, my name is Chris Harker. I represent House District 34, another side of Beaverton. I'm here in support today of House Bill 2895A because of the huge impact that statewide ballot initiatives have had on the people of Oregon and those of us who serve here in the legislature. House Bill 2895A sets up a small-scale, one-time pilot. Let me say that again. Small-scale, one-time pilot of the Citizens Initiative Review. The review engages a panel of Oregonians in a public review of ballot measures. The panel, selected to represent the demographic and geographic makeup of registered voters in the state, will participate in hearings where advocates and experts will present background and data, as well as pros and cons of initiatives. The citizen statement will be a citizen statement will be issued and published in the voter's pamphlet for each measure that is reviewed by a citizen's panel. The statement will include the number of panelists supporting, opposing, or undecided about the measure and their reasons behind those positions. House Bill 2895A gives the state an opportunity to try out this reform and examine its efficacy. And because the one-time pilot will use private funding, there's no cost to the state. Given our current budget crisis, ensuring that the citizens of Oregon have as much information as possible regarding these initiatives should be a priority. When such a huge amount of discretionary spending is dictated by these ballot initiatives, an educated public is critical. Providing people with knowledge about the impact of their vote and how it can change the way money is spent, the way laws are written, and the economic path Oregon will travel is really vital. House Bill 2895A is a great opportunity to demonstrate that this legislature cares about making sure voters have access to quality information while preserving Oregonians' rights to use the initiative process. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify here today, and I'd be happy to try to answer your questions, and the ones that I can't answer could probably be very well answered by my guest here, who might well introduce himself if you like.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Certainly. Chair Devlin, for the record, my name is Elliot Shuford. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm the co-director of Healthy Democracy, Oregon.
Okay. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
Now I'm going to bring up Representative Parker. Did you want to close or?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Justin Black and Cappy Eaton.
Close by taking my coffee with me, if I may.
I don't see Justin Black, but we'll
go
with
Kevin. Went out in the hall to get him.
Sorry, Senator, I didn't hear you call me.
Okay.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I am here to support House Bill 2895. The League is very much concerned about voter education and their knowledge about ballot measures, whether they be referred by the legislature or whether they come by citizen initiative. And we are all in favor of trying to get as much information and education to citizens as possible about these measures before they vote on them. We have had the privilege of being involved with Healthy Democracy about this concept for some time, personally for almost 3 years for me. But the League became involved about 2 years ago. And we were very much involved with the planning for the demonstration that took place last September, and also very much involved with the evaluation of that demonstration. And since the legislature has decided not to move forward with the indirect initiative, which would allow the legislative process to discuss initiatives before they go to the ballot, we feel that this is certainly one opportunity for citizens to have a chance to be educated about what is going on with particular initiatives. So this is a one-time pilot, as was pointed out. We believe this is in the public interest, and we hope that you will move this bill forward. Thank you.
Mr. Black.
Thank you, Chair Robun, members of the committee. Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 48,000 school workers throughout the state. I'm testifying kind of neutral. We took part in this panel last election cycle with ballot measure 58. I'm pretty sure it was 58. I just have a couple questions to kind of put on the record and to voice concern over. One is, a guarantee of impartiality in the panels and how the funding is done. Right now, as the bill is written, I believe funding will come from one source, but ban contributions from unions or corporations. We think contributions from multiple locations or multiple parties so that, there's no air of impropriety in the process and that it's a very fair process. Another concern we had is that the people doing the study after the panel has adjourned is also the same people that are doing the panel. So you basically have people studying themselves whether it was a worthwhile cause and a worthwhile event. And we thought that a third party should actually do the study of whether the process actually worked and is a valuable addition to the initiative process. So I just wanted to put those two things on the record, and thank you very much.
Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Seaton, was it measure 58 that...
Yes, it was. That was the one that they investigated. That was the one in immigration, I believe.
And did the League participate?
No, the League did not participate on the panel. We had an evaluator who was there for all 5 days of the panel's discussion, but certainly only as an observer. We did not take part in
that. And, Mr. Chair, did the observer report back to the League?
Yes, we did. We've got a very comprehensive report. If you would like a copy of that report, I could make it available to you.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to create the impression that I will actually read the report, but I would like to ask you, how would you characterize that report?
Excuse me?
How would you characterize the findings?
The findings were very positive. There was some, I think, good critical, and I'm not going to be able to pinpoint that exactly. I haven't looked at it for a little while. But it, on the whole, it felt the process was both important and served its purpose. Unfortunately, it was not published in the voter's pamphlet, but that's what would happen if this passes, the statement.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Do you think that the statement having been produced by the Citizens Review Committee would have an influence on voters?
I think it would, Senator Devlin, Senator Farioli, I believe it would help them understand it. I don't know whether it would have particular influence or not, but certainly voters do go to the voter's pamphlet to get information about the ballot measures. So insofar as they read it, I would hope that it would add to their understanding.
Mr. Chairman, I regret that you dismissed the other panel because the question that I asked one of the proponents earlier is whether or not their organization could do this without the approval of the state legislature. And the answer, I believe, is yes, that any organization can organize itself to do an analysis of an initiative or a measure on the ballot and publish its findings in the voter's pamphlet. So I'm curious to know why anyone would perceive the need to have a state-sanctioned review party or review board or legislatively approved review board. So, okay. That was not a question for this panel.
Okay. Any additional questions?
I try to answer it, but I will not, Senator Farioli.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to go on to another bill. And on that other bill, there are going to be a number of people that will want to testify. But actually, what I'm going to do on that bill is to take the two representatives and then go back to some bills that people waited here for a long time yesterday, and because we went over on some bills, weren't able to testify. So let's go to open a public hearing on 2940A. And can the committee administrator give a brief overview? And can Representative Edwards please come forward? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2940 allows a biomass electricity generating facility that became operational before January 1, 1995 to comply with Oregon's Renewable Portfolio Standard if it is located in Oregon and meets requirements for qualified facility under the Federal Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1975. Authorizes Public Utility Commission to allow full recovery of costs by public utilities and prudent energy investments related to hydro and power stations. Modifies electricity generated from hydrogen gas may be used to comply with RPS to include electricity generated by hydrogen power stations using anhydrous ammonia as a fuel source.
Okay. Either Representative Gilliam or Representative Edwards, please start off.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chris Edwards, State Representative in West Eugene, Santa Clara and Junction City, House District 14. I will be speaking primarily, there are two parts of this bill. I will be speaking to the biomass part of the bill, and my colleague, Representative Gilliam, will speak to what's the other part of the bill?
Hydrogen
part of the bill. It's my opinion that the policies of the state ought to encourage and incent sustainable use of our resources, especially our renewable resources like biomass. But as many of you know, coming out of Senate Bill or the Renewable Portfolio Standard this last in 2007, we have a policy in this state that says yes to post 1995. Biomass energy projects, but no to pre-1995 biomass projects. And that may have made sense in a larger RPS bill last session, but in my opinion, it doesn't make policy sense with regard to biomass. This bill attempts to fix what I see as an inequity, and I believe that the biomass projects were caught up in this 1995 date debate and should not have been treated the same as say, hydro. Now, these biomass projects are owned by companies who are operating in a competitive landscape. To treat post-1995 policy or facilities, such as is likely to be built in my district, favorably puts the pre-1995 facilities at an economic disadvantage for a reason that I frankly think is arbitrary as it relates to biomass energy projects. And I think we should change that. If the pre-1995 facilities who are competitively disadvantaged operate at a lower capacity or close because their competitiveness is compromised, then we've created a situation where we will be taking biomass, loading it on a truck, shipping it hundreds of miles over passes and such to take to a more competitive facility. Now, colleagues, that doesn't make economic sense, and it doesn't make environmental sense. But it is a reality if these facilities may face if the playing field isn't leveled. The distribution of many of these facilities is weighted heavily toward rural Oregon, where the biomass resource is. It makes absolutely no environmental sense to put that biomass on a truck and haul it longer distances to new facilities, such as are located or likely to be located in my district. This type of work is very low margin work, I know, because I prior to running for the legislature, I spent 8 years in the forest products industry. My company produced biomass. We put it on a truck, and we had to haul it all the way down to White City over a mountain pass, and that truck then would come back empty, and it just didn't make sense that we would have to do that. And in fact, if we don't pass this bill, you're going to have a competitive disparity. And so I understand in recent days there have been some folks that may have some concerns about this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding it and encourage your support.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vic Gilliam from District 18. I just come to you from the Joint Committee of both the House and the Senate Environment and Water, where Senator Dingfelder asked me to indicate to Senator Atkinson that you're sorely missed. I'm going back there after this testimony. Mr. Chair and members, although I do have considerable power and authority in the building, occasionally I've discovered that I need other people to make things happen. And I want to, first of all, say how grateful I am to my colleague, Representative Edwards, because through a clerical error, my bill...
The good senator to the left is not reflecting the chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Proceed.
I will focus my comments. And I want to say thank you to Representative Edwards, because a clerical error killed my bill. And he had a relating clause and a kind heart, but I hope also a supportive attitude. I certainly support what he's trying to do, so we combine these bills, and that's what you have in front of you today. I believe that there is a terrific amount of potential for Oregon and for the region in hydrogen powered. Please don't think hydrogen cars. That is a great technology and a great genre, but this is generation of electricity through hydrogen. We have the technology to both crack the hydrogen out of water, to store it safely, and then to burn it cleanly. And the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance, in association with folks like the utilities that we all know and love, from Pacific Core to PGE, and including the Bonneville Power Administration, I believe we'll have a hydrogen hub for all of us to sort of go in and kick the tires within the next 2 years, so that this next session I can show you more clearly what I'm talking about. But basically, from a layman's point of view, I would just say this is about just store it. That is, we have one of the most incredible energy systems in the world in the Northwest, namely our hydroelectric system. And the problem is controlling the power. The river rushes, the wind turbines turn in the spring when we don't need the power, and then the problem comes in August with the peaks that that require so much power that we can't regulate the power. So therefore, if we could store it safely and cheaply and cleanly at the center of load, we could strengthen, not create a new system, no new infrastructure, but actually strengthen that which we already have. I think that the potential for this in the Northwest and for it to be a power of regional preference for the Northwest is immense. That's why I'm bringing this forward, and that's why I believe that it ought to be part of the renewable portfolio. And if, as you probably can see from your file, the PUC agrees, and I hope you will pass the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Before we go to questions, are you aware of either of you, of the Dash A6, A7, or A8 amendments, and do you have a position on them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just came down from, we're in committee, down in the Rules Committee. I don't have my folder with me, so I don't know which one is which. I am aware of some amendments that are out there, so if you could indulge me and tell me which ones are which.
Okay.
That would be
I will have the committee administrator briefly go through them, but for the sake of the record, it is the intent not to bring this bill into work session today. So you will have a chance to at least review the amendments. So why don't you please briefly go over them.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash A6 amendment authorizes electricity generated using municipal solid waste to be used to comply with RPS. The Dash A7 authorizes to up to 40 average megawatts from certain hydroelectric facilities not owned by an electric utility to be used to comply with RPS. And the Dash A8 amendments authorize the use of electricity from certain hydroelectric facilities owned by a consumer-owned utility and generating an average of no more than 5 megawatts per year to be used to comply with RPS.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
at this point?
In recognizing that the bill's in your committee, in your side of the building now, I am agnostic on the proposed amendments, and I want the biomass piece passed. That's what I've been working on in talking with the good representative to my left here. It became clear that his amendments were going to be beneficial in getting it through the House, and in fact it was on a 58 or 59 to zero vote. And so we commend that bill to you. If it's the will of the committee to move it out, move it to the Senate floor with said amendments, then I'm supportive of that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you can't imagine how much confidence I have in this committee to do the right thing.
Okay. It's one of the most kind things that's been said to this committee in recent years.
We don't get that a lot.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or was as much sincerity, Senator Burdick.
Now, just so that people understand what's happening, I'm going to close that public hearing, and I will be coming back to it later. I'm going to go to the bill. I'm going to go back to the work session on House Bill 2895A, open that work session. Okay, there's no amendments.
Chair, are you looking for a motion?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Chair, I move House Bill 2895A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, House Bill 2895A has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, the object of the bill, I believe, is to allow organizations to work cooperatively to establish citizens' panels to review and create, to review initiated state measures and to create voters' pamphlet statements to educate the public. Which right they have now. There's certainly nothing preventing any organization from doing this. Matter of fact, many do. The cost is not just minimal to the state. There is no cost to the state. The only purpose that I see here is to give one or more of these panels the imprimatur of the legislature by creating this bill, which calls for this provisional citizen initiative review committee and sets up a procedure by which the state would pay for it, it looks like. So I guess I have to question the need for such a bill, since the rights of all citizens to participate in exactly the way outlined in this bill already exist.
Any additional comments? For the record, I would like to indicate that the parties came to me and may have come to other members of the committee fairly early in the process, indicating that they were hopeful that they could try this as a one-time experiment. There have been other issues surrounding the initiative process, and I just personally thought it was worthwhile. There are no state dollars actually involved in this effort to try this one-time effort. Obviously, with the size of our voters' pamphlets, particularly on measures, I don't know if their work is ever going to be read to that level of detail, but I thought it was worthwhile to at least try this one time. I do remember in a previous election cycle, and I cannot remember the exact year that was, there were a group of former deans who actually came together to put a statement in and did a fairly objective analysis of initiatives before the voters. Okay, is there any additional discussion? I will have the roll called on this measure.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Yes.
Senator Lester?
Aye.
Mr. Ferrioli?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Metzger, would you be willing to carry?
Sure.
Okay. We will now... Yesterday, we had a number of issues before the committee, and there were some parties that had to wait here a pretty long time before the chair made a decision that he would never get to those issues. So the chair is actually going to go back to those items to make sure that they don't have to wait here towards the end, and again, I have to end up canceling. So I'm going to go, first of all, to SB 776. This is and I'm going to open a work session on SB 776. And can the administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 776 adjusts fees for materials to be included in voters' pamphlets, requires Secretary of State by rule to provide for size and length of statements. You will see a -2 amendment. It was in your packet yesterday, and we have it again if you need it today. Rather than try to summarize it, I put a table in your SMS that shows the changes and the increases in fees at all levels of races.
Okay. And to indicate also that in this particular case, this bill is going to be going on to Ways and Means. And for the record, I may indicate that the revenue that is envisioned in this particular measure is actually already being counted on by the co-chairs of Ways and Means. Do I have a motion on the -2 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 776.
Okay. The -2 amendments to SB 776 have been moved. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Question. Aren't these a doubling of the fees?
Yes, they are.
It's an absolute double? Is that what it
all Not in all cases. In some cases, it may be a little bit higher than that.
For your office, Senator, it's 2.5 more.
2.5 more. But we are still not, I don't believe, paying 50% of the cost of the voter's pamphlet. And given what other cuts are made in the budget, I thought that, and I think others think that it's a reasonable thing to propose, since I don't think you get a better deal on any publication that you might have to make during that process. Is there any additional discussion on the -2 amendments? Any objection to the -2 amendments? Hearing none, motion passes. Yes,
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 776 as amended with a due pass recommendation and recommending that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. It has been moved that SB 776 as amended be re-referred for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any additional discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passes.
close the work session. Okay, we will go to 783. Yeah. We do have a few people signed up for 783. It is both a hearing and probable work session. Can the committee administrator give a brief overview and include in her overview the amendments to the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 783 defines petition committee as chief petitioner or treasurer of initiative, referendum, or recall petitions. Who files statement of organization with Secretary of State, aligns chief petitioner committees with candidate and political committees regarding reporting of contribution expenditure transaction, requires chief petitioner committees to open dedicated bank account to file a certification of limited contributions and expenditures and file transactions electronically, prescribes information that may be reported within filing electronic transactions, requires existing petition committees to establish petition account and amend statement of organization by January 1, 2010, limits use of contributions by committees, increases aggregate contributions for filing statement of organizations, requires independent contributions and expenditures to be reported electronically within 7 days of receipt, requires a report be filed no later than the day 2 days after receipt of contribution made during a special legislative session, becomes operative January 1, 2010. Declares an emergency and effective upon passage. You have two amendments. The -4 amendment eliminates reporting requirements related to details of agent expenditures, requires reporting overall contribution to the agent with purpose code, adjusts account payable and receivable requirements, requiring reporting only if contribution is not received or expenditure is not paid by reporting deadlines, change spot check process to a biannual requirement where a percentage of all committees who have had a transaction in a given 6-month period will be randomly selected and then will be randomly selected upon 10 transactions from those committees. You also have a -7 amendment. It changes record retention period for political committees to 2 years from date of transaction, applies to statements filed before, on, or after January 1, 2010, gives Secretary of State 90 days after receipt of political or petition committee's notice of intent to discontinue the statement of organization and close account to notify committee that statement is sufficient or not, gives the Secretary of State an additional 90 days for review if additional expenditures, transactions are reported after filing notice to discontinue. Candidate or committee may discontinue committee and close accounts upon notification by the Secretary of State that all statements filed are sufficient, requires notification within 90 days of adequacy response to correct an insufficient statement, and if no confirmation is received, the person is not subject to civil penalty, limits time to begin an investigation and issue notice of violation 2 years following date of the transaction, requires candidate and political committee or treasurer of initiative, referendum, or recall petition to update certain information on statements of expenditures and contributions. The other previously discussed provisions are applicable to actions occurring on or after January 1, 2010. Allows the state archivist to adopt rules for the retention and disposition that is of records that are maintained on the Internet.
Okay. Ms. Wilson and Ms. Bays from the Secretary of State's office. And if you could please just identify your record and begin at your leisure. And please limit your testimony to about 3 minutes each.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Wilson. I work for the Secretary of State. I have with me Brenda Bays, who is our interim election division director. We're here to testify on the -4s. Those are the amendments that we had submitted. When Secretary Brown took office, one of the first steps that we had was to sit down with campaign finance preparers, both of large and small firms and from both parties. And we were trying to find some consensus ways that we could make the system less burdensome and reduce the hurdles for folks seeking elected office. But at the same time, we were wanting to make sure that we were keeping transparency. We think the result of these discussions of the -4 amendments and that they should reduce the risks that are outside of the committee's control while ensuring transparency in elections. So first, we've changed accounts receivable and accounts payable. We're changing the way that they have to be reported. The change will mean that a candidate will only have to file or to report these transactions if it is not received by the transaction due date. Otherwise, it's just going to be reported within the existing timelines. This eliminates candidates having to guess the dollar amount for an invoice or a contribution that they have not received and don't have record of. Next, we are deleting the requirements for agent expenditures. These are typically things that are associated with media buys made by committees through an approved agent. And under current law, the detailed report contains the weekly breakdown of all the spots purchased from a TV or radio stations. The problem with this is when that information is changed, and it often changes, the information, then the candidate is on the hook for those changes. And so what we're asking is that candidates will still have to report to their media buyer that this is what they have made expense for, but the actual breakdown of stations is not required because that those change so frequently. Also, that information is available to the TV stations as well.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
You said report to their media buyer or report to you?
They have to. They'll report to us that they made an agent. They made a an expense to a buyer, and it will say for television.
Good enough.
But
thank
this,
you.
That's yeah. And then we're also going to be reducing the number of spot checks required by statute. Currently, candidate committees have quarterly spot checks of up to 8 transactions. Both the Elections Division and candidates committees find this to be burdensome. So we'd like to change those spot checks. We want to do them biannually at random selection. Our office will provide clarification on the random selection rule, but we think that this will, one, dramatically reduce the number of spot checks, but we don't think it's going to affect the deterrent factor since committees will still be advised to keep their records accurate in case of a spot check review. And then finally, the amendment changes the maximum civil penalty that can be imposed per transaction. The current maximum per transaction is $10,000, which we just believe to be onerous. We're proposing a much more reasonable maximum of 10% of the value of a transaction. With that, we just want to thank all of the folks that were CERT preparers who worked with us on this, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the representatives from the Secretary of
State's Chair,
office?
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I understand that the Dash 4 amendments to this bill were produced by a working group. I'd like to hear a little of the background of that working group.
Okay. Well, what we did, when Secretary Brown took office, that we asked staff to give us a cross-section of all of the ORSTAR preparers who were carrying the largest caseloads. We asked for both the folks who were representing the D's and the R's, is how it's breaking down, and then a host of measure committees. We had a couple of folks who did more 501c3c4 groups. And we asked them all to come down to the Secretary of State's office. And we said, you know, what's giving you the most heartburn, and where can we find some agreement about what needs to be fixed?
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
And the Dash 4s are the product of that.
They absolutely
those
are.
Suggestions. Okay. And Mr. Chairman, are the Dash? Where did the Dash 7s originate?
The Chair should perhaps answer that question.
Would you like to step forward?
The Dash 7s come from discussions. Particularly in the Senate, between both caucuses. Many members were suggesting amendments to this process. We've looked at many of those proposals. I've met initially and a couple of times, I believe, with the Secretary of State. There have been staff work groups working with the Secretary of State on some of those amendments, and that's basically where the Dash 7s have come from. Yes.
Could you refresh us on what those? I'm familiar now with the fours.
In the committee administrator.
Could you update us on what all is on the table right now?
Yes.
The Dash 7s, to begin with, they change record retention period for political committees to 2 years from date of transaction and applies to statement filed before, on, or after January 1, 2010. It gives the Secretary of State 90 days after receipt of a political or petition committee's notice of intent to discontinue the statement of organization and close accounts to notify committee that statement is sufficient or not. Gives the Secretary of State an additional 90 days for review if additional expenditure transactions are reported after filing notice to discontinue. Candidate or committee may discontinue committee and close accounts upon notification by the Secretary of State that all statements filed are sufficient. Requires notification within 90 days of adequacy of response to correct an insufficient statement, and if no confirmation is received, the person is not subject to civil penalty. Limits time to begin investigation and issue notice of violation to 2 years following date of the transaction. Requires candidate and political committee or treasurer or initiative referendum or recall petition to update certain information on statements of expenditures and contributions. And the previous provisions are all applicable on or after January 1, 2010. Allows the state archivist to adopt rules for the retention and disposition of records that are maintained on the Internet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm comfortable with the fours, but can you tell me a little bit? Can you help me get comfortable with the sevens? Because they seem a little bit more politically oriented.
I might be able to help on that, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
And I don't want to do that.
Well, Senator Metzger, why don't you respond?
Okay.
And I believe that some of these came forward with some discussions, not all of them, but some of them, with Senator Farrell, if he would like to respond.
Well, just my perspective, Senator Atkinson, I think this is a good amendment. I think this, the whole thing, it makes things much more efficient while still doing the job that we need the Secretary of State to do. One of the perspectives I have on the Dash 7 and what could happen, and I don't know if you've ever received a notice from something that was 3 or 4 years ago, that if you were to, say, discontinue your committee, I'm discontinuing, I have, no contributions anymore, I've donated my money to whatever, and I'm done. The way it could be now, 3 years from now, the way it's happened, you could get a notice from Secretary of State, Senator Atkinson, we found a transactional error, and you owe $10,000. $5,000 or whatever that may be, could be a fine, and you have no account anymore or no money to pay for that, even that civil fine, out of your account because you have no account. So it's coming out of your pocket, even though you could have paid that if it's, a civil violation, out of the Secretary of State. What this says is that, okay, if you're going to close down, you tell the Secretary of State, hey, look, I'm closing down. Take a look at everything I got. If you find any errors, do it while I still have some money in my account to pay whatever fine I might have to pay before I close this out, and don't give me a letter 3 years later when I can't do anything about it. That's the intent. I believe that, and I think it's a good one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any additional questions, or Senator Farrell, did you want to comment at all?
I think that my colleague covered the issue of the belated notification. The other thing is that what I'm hoping this does is make it clear that because the candidates only have to retain their records for a two-year period, that we wouldn't be looking beyond a two-year period for issues that could be brought forward. Just as was stated earlier, I guess what I'm looking for is a two-year statute of limitations, a two-year retention period, and a two-year period for exceptions. And this coincides all three.
And just that I might comment, too, since I've been working on this for some time, seeing requests from members on both sides of the aisle, is that what we're trying to do is clearly react to the fact that we have changed systems. Effective January 1st, 2007, we were a fully online system. And to some of that recognition didn't occur when we basically made that change. And so we're going back trying to clean up some of those things. And two, when you see the Dash 4s, I think one of the issues that the Secretary of State was trying to address was some of the issues over in-kind, because it has both been a difficulty for the Secretary of State and a difficulty for reporters of expenditures. So we're just trying to resolve some issues within the system. Also, I should state for the record, so that people in the audience understand this, this is a two-year period for retention of records. Obviously, you're responsible for any errors that are made, and they are often discovered very quickly. In fact, within most cases, 48 or 72 hours. However, if there is a case of misrepresentation or fraud, the person is liable for 5 years. So I think people should understand that. That does not change. The liability is still for a period of 5 years. Any additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Now I have three more people signed up, and then we will move on with this bill. Ms. Thompson, Ms. Eaton, and Mr. Neely. And Mr. Neely, why don't you start off, since you were part of that work group regarding the Dash 4s?
Thank you, Chair Devlin. For the record, Kevin Neely, and I own a company called C&E Systems, and we do a lot of C&Es. We represent probably, somewhere between 85 and 120 political action committees over the course of a biennium. I'm here in in very strong support of the Dash 4 amendments and an awfully strong support of the Dash 7 amendments after hearing the description. I was on the work group that Secretary Brown called into her office. I can report that that work group was definitely a bipartisan work group and that we universally agreed with all of the principles that are outlined in the Dash 4s, and we really appreciate the Secretary's interest in this issue and willingness to make some of these changes. I will try to adhere to the three-minute limit that the Chair has imposed and be quick here. The components of the Dash 4s that I think are most critical, frankly, are one, the change in the fine structure. I think that's critical because in the old days, when you filed a report every quarter or something like that, each report was capped at a certain level of fine. And so over the course of an election cycle, you couldn't be fined more than a certain amount. Now those fines are not ascribed to the report. They're ascribed to every single transaction. So we have an unlimited exposure as a treasurer of that committee. I'm not the treasurer for a lot of committees, but I'm the treasurer for a lot more committees than I was back in the old days because people are afraid of being treasurer, and reasonably so. I think that this provision puts some excellent sideboards on that fine structure and will still encourage adherence to the election law. I think that the change that's made around agent expenditures is it has to happen. As Senator Devlin pointed out, this was the first election cycle we actually had under the ORSTAR regime, and it's a regime because it's a lot of hard work. The agent expenditures were the single biggest problem we had. Trying to compel an agent to give you the detail of their breakdown on broadcast media is next to impossible, particularly during the seven-day period. They simply can't do it. So if you have a $3 million or $10 million media buy, trying to get that, it takes 2 days just to input the data for one of those media buys. So this is an incredibly needed change. The changes to the in-kinds, the accounts payables, and the spot checks all will reduce the burden on treasurers while maintaining the transparency in the system. I heartily endorse all of them. Again, they're important changes that I think are the outcome of the experience we had in the 2008 election cycle. As to the Dash 7 amendments, I think Senator Metzger did an outstanding job of describing the exact situation that concerns us. We had a number of committees in November around the ballot initiatives that came out in November of whatever year that was, a while back, 08. We still can't close those committees. They're still incurring bank fees. They're still incurring a whole range of other fees because we know there's going to be fines. We just haven't seen those fines yet. And so we'll probably have to keep those committees open for a little while longer. Again, and unfortunately for those committees, they still have to pay me and they still have to pay the bank. When, in theory, it would have been nice to have been able to close them within 90 days of the conclusion of the election. So, again, that's going to be a much-needed improvement that allows us to clear old committees off the books, not keep them open for two, sometimes 3 years after the fact. With that, I'd be happy to turn it over to the rest of the panel or answer any questions the committee might have.
Okay. We'll go through the rest of the panel first. Ms. Eaton and then Ms. Thompson.
I would prefer to defer to Ms. Thompson.
Yeah. Okay. Ms. Thompson.
Hi, Janice Thompson, Democracy Forum, Oregon. The background on this, from our perspective, does have to recognize that Oregon is one of now only three states without any limits on the size or source of campaign contributions. Both New Mexico and recently Illinois adopted legislatively limits. So what this means in Oregon is all we have is disclosure, and to have that system work means adequate financial support to the Elections Division, strict record retention policies, providing the authority to review disclosure reports and assess fines, all essential to, you know, ensure accuracy of the only tool we have, which is the campaign finance reporting. In terms of the Dash 4 amendments, I think it reflects a lot of the kind of fine-tuning ORSTAR kind of related work that is, you know, just fine. I have one concern about the total elimination of the itemized agent reports. I see that that's, like, you know, overly burdensome. I'm concerned that we might be swinging too far to the other perspective, you know, to the other end of the perspective. End of the spectrum, that's what I'm trying to say, with potential for one big lump sum expenditures from an agent that could, you know, be abused with like kind of the, being these big black box without adequate detail. Now that actually really indicates the fact that expenditures right now can be coded with multiple code, which I have identified as a problem, but not when the dollars, you know, are relatively low, but in the, you know, talking about a big media buy, you know, you could potentially have, you know, a big sum of money with a set of codes without much, you know, understanding where the money's coming from. So at the very least, it would seem appropriate to require some breakdown with the dollar figure linked to at least to the type of media. So if it's $100,000 for media, it's clear that it was $75,000 for TV. So I think there might be some room for amendment here. At the very least, I think this is an area, if you do it, you have to watch for potential abuses down the line. Turning to the Dash 7 amendments, and kind of where most of it is the Dash 5, Section 26, we think it's just fine. I mean, certainly understand the frustrations of being penalized when there's inaccurate information or updated information that doesn't come to somebody in a timely fashion from an in-kind donor. The one concern there is that it doesn't appear to address the situation where in-kind might come from an individual in terms of some potential penalty on the donor side, and that the language seems pretty open-ended, and so there may need to be some parameters to help kind of provide some guidelines perhaps in rulemaking. Organizationally, we oppose the Section 25 amendments. We understand the interest in syncing up record retention and the statute of limitations, but we think both of those should be longer than in current law. I recognize your point about the 5 years still being there for liability related to fraud, but I would say that instead of shifting it back to the 2-year statutes of limitations for reporting concerns, recommend consistency with that 5-year provision, or at least a term plus 1 year. In other words, you know, I would argue that the current law in this category is inadequate, and these amendments kind of make a shaky position even shakier. In Section 21.3, again, the record of retention, I would say instead of 2 years, should be either 5 years or term of office plus one. Particularly concerned about the Section 21.3, the 2-year statute of limitations, records retention, with the only change that I could find between the Dash 5 and the Dash 7 amendments relates to timing. I mean, it just seems like the Dash 7 amendments on page 10 and those timing shifts are going to cut out the ability to kind of catch errors back in 2007 and potentially into 2008. So definitely support the language about closing of committees, which was your concern. I do want to identify, however, that I think that that timeline needs to be accompanied by adequate resources. I mean, particularly thinking about a May primary candidate who shuts down, that 90-day window that the Elections Division is now operating under is right when they're doing signature verification. So I think they can do it, but, you know, there's resources going to be involved. In general, I think this bill includes lots of really, really great improvements. But some of the tweaks and suggestions in the Dash 7s really relate to inadequate resources to the Elections Division having caused delays, and now the people who kind of control the flow of the dollars want to change those rules in ways that I'm concerned would undermine confidence in the accuracy of reporting. This is a problem from both kind of a public interest perspective as well as just a political perception. So I would recommend that you stick with the Dash 5s instead of the Dash 7s. I know you haven't done, you know, because they mainly, and take a look at, lengthening to at least the term plus 1 year on both the record retention and the statute of limitations.
Ms. Eaton.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We generally are in support of Senate Bill 783. We feel that it's a good addition to what is Ms. Thompson referred to as the only thing we have with campaign finance, which is disclosure. And so we would like to keep it as tight and as open as possible. If you could do that, not if that isn't an oxymoron. We do support the Dash 4s, but in the written testimony which we submitted, we spoke to Sections 21 and 22 in the Dash 5 amendments with regard to the reporting back of the Secretary of State on filings in a reasonable time, particularly if there's a correction or a misfiling, and the committee has submitted information and then they don't receive an answer, and we think it's very important that that be addressed. We're not particularly delighted with the Dash 7s, but understand why they're there. And we are looking for more retention of records, and I alluded to them in the written testimony. But we do believe that 783 does do some things we feel need to be done. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for the panel?
Just a comment.
Yes.
I appreciate your testimony, and I think you're right, Ms. Thompson. I think some of the things can probably be concerns probably could be worked on a little bit in the rulemaking process on some of the things. Regarding the broadcast stuff, and as our first witness, Mr. Neely, pointed out, it is a very difficult thing when it's impossible to do that, and when television ads are getting bumped and you're reporting, you're paid, and then it didn't run, I mean, you can't do it. But the one, just for the audience, that is important, and Mr. D alluded to this, is that all broadcast expenditures, even without this legislation, are under law open to the public. So you can go to, if you see a spot on KGW, you can go to them and they will show you the file of anything that has been purchased, anything that is scheduled to air, you know, the cost for all of that. And so there's a double layer there under federal law as well as under the state law that, that makes that a little easier to be able to track. So, but I do agree with you that probably in the rulemaking some of this specificity could be taken care of.
Okay. Ms. Thompson, did you look like you wanted to respond?
You're absolutely correct, Senator Metzger, and overall I think, you know, we're hopefully we can go with this with rulemaking is fine. I will say that I have gone to TV stations and gotten that data, and they're not always quite as user-friendly as you might like in terms of getting that information, unfortunately, and of course none of it's online.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right that there is this little redundancy. So that's why I say I think under ORSTAR the level of detail now is like too much. Let's just not swing too far back the other way.
Yeah.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 783. Do we have a motion on the Dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair,
we have to have a work session.
Oh, open work session. Do we have a motion on the Dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, move the Dash 4 amendments. House Bill,
Senate
Bill 783.
Okay, the Dash 4 amendments have been moved to SB 783. Any discussion on the Dash 4 amendments? Any objection to the Dash 4 amendments? Hearing no objection, motion passes. Do we have a motion on the Dash 7 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, move the Dash 7 amendments.
Okay, we have the Dash 7 amendments moved to Senate Bill 783. Any discussion? I would put one thing clearly on the record. In working between this Rules Committee and the staff here and the Secretary of State's office, it's been a very good working relationship. The Secretary of State clearly realizes that there are needs to improve the system that they have. And one of the things that was mentioned in this, for instance, I'll give you a for instance, and maybe I shouldn't put this on the record, but there was the closure of the committees. There is a cost associated with that. Part of that cost is being paid for, it's not that large, it's being paid for by the earlier measure that we referred to, Ways and Means 776. Okay. Is there any objections to the dash 7? Hearing none, motion passes. Is there a motion as amended recommending referral to the Committee on Ways and Means?
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 783 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended. I said that. Oh, and further, be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay. It has been moved that this due pass as amended, recommending further referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A couple points.
Yes.
Number one, thank you to you and Senator Metzger for the explanation of sevens. That was floating around, but I thank you for the explanation. Number two, if this were the previous administration, I wouldn't support the bill. There is a leap of faith in associated with this. And I think that the new Secretary of State, Secretary of State Brown, needs a huge commendation because I trust her. And I think the Dash 7s is the real collaborative, I don't want to say bipartisan, because not that these groups are all partisan, but she really did a good turn by creating those Dash 7s. And on that alone, I'm just so, that's so, such a refreshing thing to see how the executive branches of government, that I think it's good, and I will support it.
Senator Atkinson, I appreciate your comment, but just for the sake of the record, the Dash 4s are the Secretary of State's amendments, and the Secretary of State and her staff worked very cooperatively on the Dash 7s with us.
I appreciate that, but my kudos is going to Kate Brown on the Dash 7s, for the record.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor to do pass as amended, recommending referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any additional discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Okay, now.
Did someone turn the lights on?
Let's go to 783.
Major storm warning.
Are we at ease?
Close the work session.
Can we open those? I mean, I think we're going to see something catastrophic. I don't want to.
Did you gavel us to an at ease position, Mr. Chairman?
I will. We will be at ease for about 90 seconds. Remember, everything that you say is recorded. I'm going to open a work session on SB 897, and as soon as the committee administrator comes back, did we have the people that wanted to come forward? Okay. Committee, we are in work session on SB 83, but some of the parties that had testified earlier, we wanted to make it clear that I believe that we've come to agreement on an amendment that everybody is agreeable to. So could Mr. Capps, Mr. Cleary, and Mr. Livingston come forward? And while they come forward, could the committee administrator briefly overview that this is a changed bill and what the Dash 8 amendments do?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 897 will go to the Dash 8s, and I believe Legislative Council is on their way, and they can take us to some of the technical changes in the bill. But primarily what the Dash 8s do is it keeps the PERS board at five members, allows one member of the board to be a current or retired public employee of appropriate bargaining unit, and allows a member not earlier than 2 years before earliest retirement age to request verification of retirement data from PERS board. The Dash 8 amendments that are different than the Dash 5s is that the Dash 8 provides PERS board rulemaking authority to determine process and reasonable time frame for requesting and obtaining data for public employees and from public employers after request has been made, specifies data PERS board is required to provide, data included in credible service and retirement credits, salary data reported by the member's employers for each calendar year, and the final average salary for the member derived from that data, and if applicable, the regular account balance and the total amount of unused sick leave. It provides procedures for members to dispute data, allows PERS board to recover overpayments or erroneous payments to or on an account of a member based on verification data, requires PERS member service requirement, receive retirement credit for certain retroactive payment of salary. The verification requirement becomes operative July 1, 2011, retains provision allowing retired members of Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan to be eligible for coverage under health insurance plans contracted by PERS Board.
Thank you. I see we have a distinguished panel and we are in a public hearing.
We're
in a work session, and we've invited this panel forward. Ladies and gentlemen, if you care to comment, and particularly on the Dash 8 amendment.
They should testify before lightning strikes.
And anyone may start. Mr. Clary, would you like to go first?
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. My staff worked directly with the member and employer reps and the Legislative Council on crafting these Dash 8 amendments, so we could ensure that we can implement them should the legislature give us the policy direction contained therein. And we appreciate the opportunity to do that and the helpfulness of both the employer and the member reps on that. We were asked a question last time we were here, and I just wanted to return with some data. It was actually Chair Devlin that asked the question, what percent of our retirements have a data dispute associated with them? About 2%. We, in 2007, 2008, we had 260 members out of about 12,000 retirees. So obviously this bill is aimed at trying to ensure that that moves from 98% not having a data dispute to 100%. We've got some process improvements already underway, and I just wanted to highlight those. You heard testimony earlier about currently the member is not held harmless from after-the-fact data adjustments, and actually the member bears the risk of those adjustments. This bill would change that dynamic so PERS and the employers would bear the risk for their mistakes in four employment history factors, those involving years of service, salary, Tier 1, Tier 2 account balances, and sick leave accrual. I think it's important to recognize and get on the record that a calculation math error or an IT system error or lightning striking when the system is putting out
please,
a check and instead of
Mr.
nine...
Mr. Chairman, yes. I would prefer that the witness not tempt the fate by banging a lightning strike in the middle of the
storm. If a system spews out a $9,000 check when it was supposed to spew out a $900 check, those errors can still be corrected. The only thing is you can't make changes based on the post-verification adjustments to these four factors. It's kind of you lock down this employment history, and so obviously we've got to do everything we can to get it right when we lock it down. You know, over the past 5 years, my board has been fully exposed to and very concerned with bad data, inadequate IT system capabilities, and calculation errors. So they're naturally concerned about any increase in risk associated with limiting the ability to make adjustments in the post-verification era. Our job's going to be to make them comfortable with this, to put in place the tools, the processes, and the staff training and culture necessary to minimize that risk. So we've identified some resources in our fiscal for that, and with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Okay. Is anyone left?
Oh, actually, Mr. Clary's been the only person to testify.
Oh, okay. Either Mr. Livingston or Mr. Capps.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston representing the Oregon State Firefighters Coalition as well as a partner in the PERS Coalition. Just briefly, we believe that in our partnership, not only with PERS, but with our employer groups, we have worked hard over the past week to make some technical corrections to this bill that I think is good in the interest of everyone that's involved in the PERS system. And what we're really going to be able to do with this bill is make sure that when members are making very difficult decisions as to when they will retire, the data that they will have in front of them will be as accurate as possible, and we appreciate the efforts of our employers, and particularly Mr. Cleary and Mr. Hendricks and all of his hard work over the last 2 days to make this possible. Hate to say it, but this is a good bill and should pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Education Association. I'd like to join with Mr. Livingston in his comments and say good bill should pass. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions from yes, please.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Brenda Wilson here today on behalf of the PERS Alliance representing PERS employers, and we also work closely on this bill. And although, as I testified earlier, we did have concerns, those concerns have been addressed, and we would also say good bill should pass.
Thank you very much. Any additional? Seeing none, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We will go. We're still in work session. Okay. Do we have a motion on the Dash 8 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 897.
Okay. The Dash 8 amendments have been moved to Senate Bill 897. Is there any discussion?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The Dash 8 amendments maintain the current PERS board membership at 5 members.
That is correct. I believe the only change is now the one public employee member can either be an active member or can be retired.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. Do we have a main motion? And the main motion is to do pass as amended, recommending referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 897 is amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation after a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. It has been moved that SB 897 be moved with a do pass recommendation recommending subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any additional discussion of the motion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion passes. Now, so that I can ensure that we do 2 work sessions we are scheduled for and we can do them, are the committee members going to have any discussion on the 2 work sessions? If you could look at the bottom of your agenda.
Very short.
Very short. Okay. I will open a work session on House Bill 2345. Can the committee administrators please give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2345B directs the Department of Human Services to establish a contract to establish impaired health professionals program and specifies components of the program. We had a Dash B8 amendment discussed at the second the meeting on June 2nd, and the B8 amendment modifies the licensee reporting requirement from 1 to 3 business days to report arrest or conviction of a misdemeanor or felony crime to the board. Specifies that if a licensee self-refers to the program, the licensee, to the best of the licensee's knowledge, that they are under investigation, adds the impaired professional program into the definition of public provider under the disclosure of written accounts by health care services provider. The Dash B 10 amendment is a conflict amendment. It resolves conflict between House Bill 2345 and Senate Bill 111, particularly related to clinical social workers. Dash B 11 amendment specifies the process for transferring licensees currently participating in the Impaired Professionals Program to Impaired Profession Program established by DHS. You will find in your packet a copy of each of these amendments in addition to a fiscal statement on the Dash B 10 and B 11 amendments, and we do have a no revenue statement on both of those amendments. And on the Dash B 8 amendments, similar, we have a no revenue and a fiscal statement issued on that amendment.
Okay. Yes.
Can all 3 amendments be moved at the same time?
Well, yes. Very carefully.
It's the wish of the chair to have all 3 amendments moved, then I would be happy to provide that service.
Okay. And we are absolutely assured that we have not violated any protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash B8 amendment to House Bill 2345B, the dash B10 amendment to House Bill 2345B, and the dash B11 amendment to House Bill 2345B.
Okay. And does any member of the committee wish that that motion be split? Seeing none, the motion on the table is to move the dash B8 amendments, the dash B10 amendments, and the dash B11 amendments. Any additional discussion? Seeing none, motion passes. Do we have a main motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2345B as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. House Bill 2345 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any additional discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think I support the bill, but it's pretty monumental. I'm going to be a no vote, and I'm going to study this one a little bit more closely before it hits the floor, and I might become a yes. But right now, I think it's just too big of a thing for me to pass right now.
Okay, I understand, Senator Atkinson. Could you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriero.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Chair will decide on a carrier at a later date. Okay, now we're going to go to 3094. Okay, I will open up a work session on House Bill 3094. Can you give just a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, members. House Bill 3094 extends sunset to 4 years on the conditional exemption from disclosure of public records that name the home, address, or professional location of a person associated with medical research conducted on animals at Oregon Health Sciences University. You have a dash A3 amendment which changes the sunset date to 2 years. There is a no fiscal impact and a no revenue impact on the dash 3 amendment. It comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee on a 5-0 without recommendation vote.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the effect of the dash A3 amendments is to shorten the sunset by 2 years.
That is my understanding, and my understanding is that OHSU supports that amendment. Ms. Funkhauser, would you like to come forward so it's on the record that you support
that?
or anyone from OHSU who wishes to testify.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Steve Statham. I'm Executive Vice President at OHSU. We do support the bill as amended, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
So you support the Dash 3 amendments that are before us?
Yes. Well, we're happy to work with stakeholders and the legislature during the interim to refine the processes and the issues around the exemption.
Mr. Chairman, I would certainly support the main bill.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. What stakeholders?
Well, whoever is interested. We know that there have been comments by other witnesses who would like to not see the bill continued, so that they want a shorter sunset period. And I think maybe other legislators are interested in making sure that we are striking the right balance, which we think the bill does already, between protecting researchers and access to researcher information, which are two different things.
Okay. And can you refresh the chair's memory? The last time we acted on this, was it not also a two-year extension?
Mr. Chairman, it was 4 years.
Or four. Was it four?
4 years.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was originally a four-year sunset.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3094.
Okay. Could the roll be called?
Senator Atkinson.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriero.
No.
Chair Devlin.
Aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You did not call for discussion before that vote.
Okay. Do you want to move for unanimous reconsideration
no,
so we can...
No, actually, I would like to have a discussion on that.
Yes.
Why would we shorten that, first of all? And number two,
We have a vote. We are the group that has a vote. It's called the Oregon Legislature, and in this case, it's called the Oregon Senate. I get so irritated when we constantly punt our legislative responsibilities to stakeholder work groups and blah, 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 blah. We are the stakeholder work groups. That's our job, to set the policy. And so why would we allow stakeholders and lobbyist organizations and whoever to affect what could or could... The best policy to protect these people is to lay it out for 4 years. It's not to shorten it because a stakeholder wanted it shortened. Help me understand that.
Okay. Senator, that's a question. I have not been at the core of this particular discussion. This bill came from the Judiciary Committee, I believe, and the intent is that
Mr. Chair, would you like me to help out here? This exemption actually came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee when I was chairing the committee in 2005. And I, as the committee members know, I am a fervent supporter of public access to public records under the public records law. But I was persuaded after I saw some of the agendas, training agendas from some of the extremist animal groups, and I was persuaded that there was indeed a safety issue for some of these employees up at the Primate Research Center. So I agreed to have this exemption to the public records law. My committee went along with me. And but in the interest of having the maximum transparency, I asked OHSU to develop a process where if requests did not look like they were a threat to safety, that they would be as open as possible, and they have complied with that request. And that caused some anxiety during this session under the current Judiciary Committee because there was a perception that people were treated differently, and I understand that argument as well. So I think having the two-year sunset and having a fuller discussion of how to balance safety of employees with public disclosure is in order. Does that help, Senator Atkinson?
Thank you. Yes, but I think we are the policy-setting branch of government. We will set the policy, and I think we're suffering from stakeholderitis. And so I'm going to be, I think this is good policy. I'm a giant supporter of Oregon Health Sciences. I'm trying to get the tram named after my family. I'm not going to allow us to have a... When the right thing to do is 4 years, I'm not going to allow us to do 2 years to satisfy stakeholder groups. We are here to make decisions, not punt them down the road, and so I'm a no.
Okay. Any additional comments or questions?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think the argument for the safety and security of researchers is compelling, just as the argument that the safety of researchers is compromised by the release of the information. And the threat is real. I agree with Senator Burdick. But if we find the argument to be compelling, then it certainly should be compelling for a four-year period. And if somebody wants to study the issue during the interim, that would be fine. Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily share my colleagues' antipathy to work groups. I'll be supporting the main body of the bill, but I agree that, or at least I'll assert that if this is a compelling argument for a two-year extension, it should be extended to 4 years.
Okay. My understanding is, obviously, we've already acted on the Dash 3 amendments. So is there a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3094 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, now my apologies to the committee. Is there any discussion of that motion? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll support this to go into the floor. I have voted against this before. I will vote against it on the floor. I understand the issues and the concerns, and my good colleague, Senator Burdick, I think has pointed those out in a very thoughtful way. But my history on public records is pretty well clear, even despite the genuine concerns that Senator Burdick and I disagree on. But I'll move it to the floor. But I just believe that there, I'm not so sure that this record is the true defense to protections for folks. There's other things that are involved. I don't think this necessarily provides that. But I will be voting no on the floor.
Okay. Could the committee clerk please call the roll?
I asked. No.
Aye.
Metzger.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Burdick, will you carry?
Happy to be here.
No monkeying around.
Okay, I am now going to go back. Close that work session. We will go to House. Okay. Okay, wait, let's hold on a second. Yes.
I need to be absent.
Okay.
I have a meeting.
Okay. 2482.
2682.
You're on your own, buddy.
Quit monkeying around.
Richard, can you do 2940?
Yeah, I can.
Oh, biomass.
Let's go to 2940.
Yeah, any more work sessions?
Okay. We're going to go to, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2940. Let me refresh that. It's been an interesting day. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2940A, and before we go back into 2940, I will announce to the audience what has happened over the last hour. The air conditioning system was hit by lightning and is now currently not operating. The Gold Man is fine. But it may get a little bit warmer in here. They're trying to push more air without air conditioning through this room, but it may get a little bit warmer.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Was the Gold Man the conduit for the air conditioning blowout? Or?
I do not know.
No.
But we were going to go back to this, and so I do have one party I want to call up first. Ms. Ellie Booth, could you please come forward and for your testimony on 2940? And while you do that, can the committee administrator just give a brief overview again of the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2940 allows a biomass electricity generating facility that became operational before January 1, 1995 to comply with Oregon's Renewable Portfolio Standard if it is located in Oregon and meets requirements for qualified facility under Federal Public Utility Regulatory Act of 1975, authorizes Public Utility Commission to allow full recovery of costs by public utilities and prudent energy investments related to hydrogen power stations.
Okay, Ms. Booth, would you please start?
Thank you, Chair Devlin and the members of the committee. I also wanted to introduce Jeff Bickford, who's head of Marion County Solid Waste Department as well here today. A quick overview, Marion County, Covanta, I am with Covanta Energy, and we own and operate the Marion County Energy from Waste Facility. It's just up the road on I-5. We process 185,000 tons of municipal solid waste each year. Instead of landfilling this waste is taken to our facility where we generate electricity, about 13.1 megawatts per hour, which generates about electricity for 11,000 homes. The sales of this electricity from our facility, 90% of the revenues from the electricity we sell go to Marion County, and it supports their recycling program. Marion County has the highest recycling rate in the state of Oregon, 56%. In addition to that, they have many programs like accepting vegetable oil at the curb, because of the revenues from the sale of electricity at our facility. Energy from waste is treated renewable in many other international jurisdictions. In the Kyoto Protocol, in Annex 1 and Annex 2 countries, signatories have recognized energy from waste as an offset technology to reduce overall greenhouse gases. So in consistency purposes in the U.S., it would be considered part of an RPS. The European Union, which has a very aggressive landfill bans on many states and many countries such as Germany and the U.K., encourage energy from waste as a means to not only reduce overall waste into landfill, but to reduce the methane that comes from this waste. So in the UK right now, if we are building an energy from waste permit and we do not have to get a carbon permit for that facility because of the offsetting methane that it reduces. Most recently, energy from waste facilities in the Waxman-Markey bill, which is being debated at the federal level, is included as part of the renewable portfolio standards. Why should energy from waste get credit under Oregon's RPS? First and foremost, it's an environmentally safer alternative to landfills. We have 24-hour pollution control equipment. We're one of the most strictest regulated entities out there. We manage 1 ton of municipal solid waste in an hour versus 100 years in a landfill. We lessen the dependency on fossil fuels. We're, another key issue in this debate is we're baseload power, running 24/7. We're a nice complement to the other renewable technologies. We avoid 100% of the methane from landfills. And more importantly, finally, one ton of municipal solid waste generates 550 kilowatts per hour versus if you put it in a landfill, even with a landfill gas engine, you're only getting about 120 kilowatts an hour. Finally, we're a net greenhouse gas reducer. Both EPA and Oregon DEQ recognize the benefits. According to the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming from December 2004, landfills account for about 25% of the methane generated in Oregon. I would like to request or ask the committee to support the A6 amendments because it doesn't, from a policy standpoint, if we take our municipal solid waste and bury it, and that is renewable, but we, if we take our municipal solid waste and, as Marion County does, generates electricity from that, that's not renewable. From a policy standpoint, there seems to be some inconsistencies in that. Be happy to answer any questions, and Jeff can speak to any questions that the you may have for the county.
Okay. Mr. Bickford, did you have any comments or just here for questions?
Primarily here for questions, but I do want to
reinforce yourself again for the record. So.
My name is Jeff Bickford. I'm the Environmental Services Manager for Marion County Public Works. And I do just want to, again, reinforce one thing that LA did hit on. Again, that has to do that in the current RPS here in Oregon, landfill gas that's collected and burnt for energy recovery is included as renewable, and waste energy where you're taking the same fuel, exact same fuel, and that you're getting more power from it is not. And again, it's really an equity issue. The fuel source is the same. It seems to make sense that waste energy be included in the RPS. So again, we support and recommend the A6 amendment passage.
Okay, and questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank you for bringing us this amendment because I think it's going to be very challenging as we move forward to comply with the RPS standards in Oregon. And I think I'm pleased to see this amendment before us because it's much better to have a renewable fuel in a week than in, 100 years. So thank you.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Cannon and Mr. Doug Barber. Oh, and can Michael Mason come forward also? And while they're coming forward, the committee to know that House Bill 2682B is going to be set over until tomorrow. It will be the first item on our agenda. Please proceed, and please limit your testimony to 3 minutes each.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Lincoln Cannon. I represent the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Our members own over roughly 5 million acres of forest land in Oregon and a number of forest products processing facilities. I'm here to speak to the biomass piece of 2940, the original 2940. It does a number of things relative to this. I think you've heard it allows biomass facilities that were in production producing electricity prior to 1995 to qualify as renewable electricity producers under the RPS. They are currently excluded by the RPS language in 2007. That date was arbitrary. It was intended primarily to include big hydropower. According to the Northwest Power Coordinating Council database, the 1995 cutoff date allows over 40 wind and solar projects in the Pacific Northwest, including all wind and solar, to the best of my knowledge, in Oregon. Yet, and there's potentially still more in California that are not part of that database, and yet we've excluded 9 Oregon biomass facilities. The value of RECs, renewable energy credits, that accrue to renewable electricity producers are of considerable value and would be very important to these facilities in their operations and continuing to produce electricity and potentially expand their production. Excluding them, we believe, is unfair. They compete, as Representative Edwards said, in the same markets as post-95 facilities, and therefore we think it's inequitable and puts them at a disadvantage. I'm not sure where I am in my 3 minutes, so I'll jump to the bottom line. House Bill 2940A is a bipartisan, common-sense correction to Oregon's RPS statutes. It supports retention and potential expansion of renewable energy resources. It helps support manufacturing facilities and infrastructure and jobs in rural Oregon. There was a map on the second page behind my testimony that shows where these facilities are located. They're in John Day, they're in Roseburg, they're in Medford, places where we are suffering, and this would be a real help to these facilities to be able to qualify as renewable energy producers. Thank you.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber, here on behalf of a coalition of small hydro projects in the state. On the back of the testimony that I gave you, there's a chart that shows you the projects that would qualify. This is under the A7 amendments, which we support. These projects are owned by irrigation districts, the Warm Springs Tribe, the City of Portland, some small independent hydro producers. The A7 amendment would cap pre-1995 non-utility hydro projects at 40 megawatts for purposes of the RPS. RPS allows pre-95 hydro for if it's owned by a utility. This would add to that non-utility hydro projects that are pre-95. We have been told by a variety of sources that it was an oversight in the RPS that the way this piece of the bill was written. We believe, as Representative Edwards said about the biomass bill, that this amendment attempts to fix an inequity in the bill. These small hydro projects, in order to qualify under the -7 amendments, would be required to get national certification. This is Lehigh or Leahy certification. This is the only part of the RPS that I know of that has a national standard like this that would be required for these projects to qualify. Currently, I believe only 3 of the projects on the list have Leahy certification. One of the others, the Farmers Irrigation District, has applied. The value for these projects from RPS, the increased income that it would bring to these projects, would allow them to maintain and constantly improve their projects. In order to qualify for Leahy certification, many of them would have to improve fish passage, water quality. So there's an environmental benefit for the state. There's a financial benefit for the projects. And these older renewable projects are far less expensive to ratepayers than building new projects. Both create the same renewable benefit. It provides both Oregon and the country with the least expensive source of renewable energy, and we encourage your support for the A7 amendments. Thank you.
Mr. Mason.
Thank you. Chair Devlin and members of the Senate Rules Committee, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, which includes the Warm Springs Power and Water Enterprise, which manages the tribal side of the Pelton Round Butte project. The two big dams on the Deschutes, which I think everybody's familiar with, are co-licensed to Portland General Electric and the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. The dam that is downstream, the Re-Reg Dam, is owned by the Warm Springs Tribes. And it is already low-impact hydro certified because, you know, the primary purpose of that dam, I mean, there's a purpose in power generation, of course, and it does generate about 18 average megawatts, or it has that capacity, I should say. But it was installed, that dam was placed, to regulate the flow of water from Pelton around Butte, which those dams are managed for peak power demand, so the turbines are running full bore during the day but rest at night. That means that we're having a lot more flow during the day. That's, without the re-reg dam, very disruptive to fish, harmful to the habitat. So the tribes understood this to be essential to that stretch of the Deschutes River to put in that dam. At any rate, that benefit to fish is very significant, and again, the tribes 2 years ago were very active on the Renewable Energy Act effort, strong supporters of it, did not realize that there was going to be this hydro aspect of it. That was a last-minute deal, as we understand it from our friends at PGE, but now would like to be included in this. It's not a lot of money for us. Our estimate, having checked around trying to sell the RECs, is it's worth $100,000 to $120,000, but that is significant for a tribe with a 60% unemployment rate. You heard some yesterday about the high unemployment in, or you have heard over time about the high unemployment rate in Jefferson County. A lot of that is the Warm Springs Reservation. So thank you for your testimony. We support the -A7 amendments and hope you'll see fit to include those in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Any questions for any of the panels? Thank you very much. Mr. Bissonnette, Mr. Conkling.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, today representing the Renewable Northwest Project. Biomass is recognized as a renewable resource under Oregon's Renewable Portfolio Standard. That standard, which was adopted by the legislature just 2 years ago, is intended to encourage new investment in renewable resources. The targets that were set in the Renewable Portfolio Standard were set based on the mix of renewables that were included in the 2007 legislation. The 1995 cutoff may or may not be arbitrary, but in any case, it is significant to looking at the mix of the renewables relative to what is included and not included. Renewable Northwest Project's concern with 2940 as written is that it qualifies nine pre-1995 facilities that would account by our calculation for 123 average megawatts of power, which would represent a fairly substantial portion of the RPS, perhaps as much as 11% of it or more. We believe these existing facilities do have value, and the proponents have talked about them. They do provide electricity today. They're meeting base load. And in our view, the issue before you is not really about the survival of these plants. It's really a question about money. Under current law, if investments are made that produce efficiency gains or expand these facilities, those marginal additions would already qualify under the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We, in assessing the situation and understanding the politics involved, are willing to live with an approach that would incent the owners of these facilities to modernize and upgrade them, and to, by doing that, qualify some portion of their current output for the RPS. We think this particular approach is consistent with both the spirit and intent of the Oregon RPS in encouraging new investment that will expand our portfolio of renewable resources to meet future load growth as well as existing load in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Bissonnette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette for the Citizens Utility Board, representing residential ratepayers. I will echo Mr. Conkling's remarks. We have many of the same concerns. We would, however, agree with the approach that he just outlined, because our in the renewable portfolio standard, we were focused on resources going forward, not resources already meeting load. And in dealing with other existing resources, such as utility-owned hydro projects being getting low-impact certification, there was an investment being made. Ratepayers were getting value for new investment and getting more efficiencies, more capacity out of those investments. And so it made sense as we were investing in new resources to sort of to count those toward the RPS. And so the approach that Mr. Conkling just outlined for biomass is in keeping with that, and we would agree with that. In addition, we could also look at an approach that's similar or a similar approach used in California, where if investments are made to the extent that 80% of the value of a facility is invested, essentially repowering the facility, that all of the output for that is used to count toward the RPS. And so there's a number of different options that we think can underscore that we recognize the value of these resources, but ratepayers also get additional value to meet load on a going forward basis. I'll also note that many of these resources, these facilities, are very old. It's not like they just missed the 1995 cutoff. More than half of the load represented by these are from 1938 to 1961 facilities. And then the remaining ones, one is in 1975 and two in 1986. So for the most part, these are old facilities, serving base load, and that's great, but again, we're looking at resources moving forward to meet load growth. Just a quick question on the amendments, the A6 amendments by Covanta. Those were considered last time and not taken in. I didn't hear any new information that would suggest that we need to change the policy on that. On the A7s, it's a very limited impact for the non-utility low-impact certified hydro, and it provides a nice symmetry between utility-owned hydro resources and non-utility-owned hydro resources. We would support that. And the dash A8s, I have no opinion on. With that, thank you for your time. Happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Conkling or Mr. Bissonnette? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here today. Let's see. Mr. Barrows? And I'm going to call up at the same time Mr. Vantoff, and it looks like Kip Phil. I can't make out the last name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing Northern Wasco People's Utility District, a small utility up in the based in the Dalles, here in support of the A8 amendments that would allow a facility they've got to qualify under the RPS. They've got a facility that's fish-friendly, was created specifically for that purpose, and but also generates power for them. But it was built, or became operational in 1993, so it missed the cutoff to qualify under the RPS. After 95, they also have another facility up at McNary Dam that's even larger, but does qualify. So it doesn't make much sense. It's sort of like they're being punished for being an early adopter. And part of the problem is also it counts as part of their total load, so by not qualifying under the RPS, they've got to offset that with something else that does. So I ask that you would support the A8 amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barrows. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Vantoff from the Governor's Office, for the record. The The governor and the legislature in 07 passed one of the strongest portfolio standards in the country, and it's been tremendously successful. And the proposals before us today raise concerns for us in terms of how they would affect that the structure of that RPS. As was noted previously, the intent of the RPS was to focus on integration of new sources of renewable energy into the system, and it has been doing that very well. Adding additional resources at this point, biomass or other resources, we fear will upset the calibration that was put into the 07 legislation and could run a significant risk of compromising or even rendering useless the existing momentum under the RPS that we've built. Kip File from Department of Energy can talk a little bit about the numbers that they've analyzed, but we're of the belief that if the legislation passed, there would, based on what the utilities already have been able to integrate into the system, they're doing great. They're ahead of schedule, but that if we were to bring in these resources now without changing the requirements under the RPS, that we would no longer need to integrate new sources of renewables in the short or long term under the current structure. So, if anything, we think that there should be a conversation around whether the current effort under the RPS is the right amount. If we're having a conversation around bringing in older resources that were not built into the structure of the bill that passed in 07, and this is not. Just to be clear, the governor is a strong supporter of biomass and other all sources of renewable energy. In prior sessions with the legislature and the governor have pushed for passage of expanding tax credits for biomass energy to try and help them make them more pencil out going forward for new sources, both about biomass and biofuels uses. This session, the governor is supportive of amendments to, again, remove barriers for biomass generation in House Bill 2180. And we're very open to conversations about how to integrate prior sources of biomass or other renewables, but we're just concerned about how it's done in this bill.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kip File. I work at the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm just going to talk about the status of the RPS and what the change in this bill would be. I'll talk a little bit about the municipal solid waste and then also some of the revenue projections. The first point in terms of status, the projection is that the three large utilities that are subject to compliance in 2011 will need to produce about 200 average megawatts of electricity that qualifies under the RPS to satisfy their 2011 standard. It's projected that they will be producing almost 400 average megawatts in 2011. So they will have basically double what they're required to have in 2011 under the current development of projects that they have in the pipeline. Additionally, because the RPS provides credit for early work, they will have a banked amount approximately 700 average megawatts. So that's another 350% of what they are needed to produce in 2011. They'll be able to accumulate that if they hold on to their certificates. If we add the pre-95 biomass by itself, as the Oregon Forest Industries Council testified, that's 124 average megawatts, which, again, that's more than half of what that 2011 standard is. If they're able to bank certificates from those facilities for 2010, that means they'll satisfy the entire 2011 requirement, or potentially satisfy entirely the 2011 requirement with these pre-95 facilities. In regards to the use of municipal solid waste, I would point out that the fuel source is dramatically different in a landfill gas project as opposed to an incineration project, in that a vast majority of the energy that is converted into electricity in a municipal solid waste project is fossil fuel derived. There's natural gas co-firing to make the system operate properly, and then there's a large volume of plastics, which of course generated from fossil fuels. Finally, the other element of it is that the rec value for these older facilities will probably be far below what is anticipated to provide that extra incentive to those facilities, because their only market will be to Oregon Utilities, and the Oregon Utilities presumably would not pay top dollar for those certificates. Whereas if they're able to qualify under the existing RPS, it would also make them eligible in many other state programs and provide a wider market for their certificates. Thank you for your time, and would answer any questions.
Fantastic. Any questions for the panel? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2940A. This bill will be having further discussion by the committee. Probably, I don't believe it's up tomorrow, but we may have further discussion on it early next week. This committee is going to be open at least probably for 1 week more. With that, I think our business for today is concluded. And we will be meeting at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and hopefully the air conditioning will be working.
Actually, it feels warm. It feels cooler.